ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Wars, fuel shortages, climate change, violence, the world can be a pretty depressing place, especially if you're a person who likes to stay informed. But what if instead of letting the constant fire hose of worrying news make you jaded and cynical, you met it with hope and optimism? In the next 20 minutes, let's talk positive psychology, not to be confused with toxic positivity, but an optimism that inspires action. Also ahead, most teenagers don't meet the recommended amount of physical activity. When I say most, I mean like 80%. Could one small change, making it okay to wear sports uniforms to school every day, help change that? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, in the last 5 years, adult diagnoses of ADHD in Australia have soared. It is now estimated to affect around 2.5 to 3% of adults. And for lots of you, getting a diagnosis has been life-changing. It means finally understanding the way your own brain works after years of confusion, frustration, and shame. And crucially, a diagnosis can unlock access to support and treatment. But the system has serious problems. Last night, ABC's Four Corners program revealed the first comprehensive map of adult ADHD diagnoses across the country. And in some areas, prescription rates for ADHD medication are much higher than expected, which has raised concerns among experts that with demand booming, some assessments might be rushed, or in some cases, people could be misdiagnosed. At the same time, there are other areas where ADHD is being missed entirely. So what's going on? And if you're trying to get assessed or find support, how do you know where to turn? Sarah Hayden is a social worker and a parent to two neurodivergent kids who received her own ADHD diagnosis 3 years ago when she was in her 40s. Sarah, welcome to Life Matters. First of all, what's it like getting an ADHD diagnosis as an adult?
I think it came with a lot of mixed emotions. For me, there was, it's probably fair to say, a lot of grief. There was a lot of tears, but it was also a huge relief and kind of really lovely to actually understand why I had perhaps lived my life like I had, and that there was, sort of a better understanding of my brain and what I needed moving forward.
So you got diagnosed after you had a couple of your children were diagnosed with being neurodivergent, but you intentionally sought out a different doctor to the one that did their diagnosis. Why is that?
Yeah, correct. So it was actually on the back of my daughter, Chloe, who was diagnosed autistic at 13. And then around the age of, I think it was 21-ish, she was diagnosed ADHD. I attended her numerous sessions with the psychiatrist, and as we were going through all of the diagnostic criteria and checklists and history, I was like, oh my goodness, this is me to a T, and I didn't realise. And, you know, I sort of said it half jokingly at the end of, you know, the couple of months it took to get the diagnosis and made a comment to the psychiatrist. And, you know, I then sort of started doing a lot of research and reading and, you know, reading books and literature and in particular on, you know, the presentation of women. And the more I read about it, the more I just thought, my goodness, this is me. And as a professional actually working in the space, I didn't for many years sort of think there was much point in getting a diagnosis. And then I realised, you know, that I was struggling with a lot of things. And I think like a lot of women, I hit perimenopause and I felt that the presentation or how, you know, ADHD was working for me in my brain was getting more and more difficult. And I was really curious to know, you know, maybe did I have ADHD and did I want to actually get a diagnosis? And Eventually, I decided I did, but I intentionally did go to a different doctor because I didn't want it to be somebody who knew who Chloe was, or that, you know, that I'd sat there with her in the, you know, diagnosis sort of sessions. I wanted it to be very independent. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, that I was getting it for, I guess, you know, the right reasons, and that I wasn't going in there giving them, you know, a reason to diagnose me if they didn't.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Sarah Hayden about getting diagnosed with ADHD in her 40s. Sarah, that's your personal experience with getting an ADHD diagnosis later in life, but you're also involved in this space in a professional capacity. You're a social worker at a clinic that assesses ADHD and autism. And the rise in telehealth clinics was one of the factors that the Four Corners study explored in its investigation. I just want to play you a snippet from the reporter, Norman Swan.
So there's been the growth of large telehealth clinics who do a broad range of psychiatry, but in fact, their core offering is ADHD and autism spectrum disorder diagnosis. So there are questionnaires which are well validated, which you can do yourself, which some people are misled into thinking are diagnostic. And they really are only just a bit of help for the psychiatrist. People like Professor David Cockhill at the University of Melbourne, who's one of Australia's leading experts, in fact, an international expert in ADHD, are worried about the quality of assessment.
Questionnaires are not accurate enough, and they do lead to what we call a lot of false positive recognition of ADHD.
A psychiatrist should not rely on these questionnaires for diagnosis. They are not diagnostic tools. Yet anecdotally, we hear of clinics where the psychiatrist accepts the findings of the questionnaire, gives you a short consultation, and you go away with a script for a psychostimulant. Mm. And we don't know the rate at which they say no.
So that was Norman talking on ABC News Daily. Sarah, as someone who works in that space, how do those comments land for you?
Look, I would like to respectfully disagree with those comments. I think certainly there probably is, just like in any industry, there's people who are not necessarily the best people to be doing things, or there could be dodgy practices in any area. But in this particular area, I think we're getting a pretty bad rap at the moment for late diagnosis, full stop. In particular, say, just using the example of where I work, we have a multidisciplinary team. So that consists of psychologists, OTs, and social workers. And it's multiple online assessments, which are interviews, in-depth questionnaires, a lot of questionnaires that that person, their family, their school teacher, you know, other significant others in their life. You know, we're looking at lifelong, we're not looking at just now and how they are at the moment, and, you know, obviously ruling out other things. I think that there's sort of this misconception at the moment, and you keep seeing in the media that, you know, it's trendy or people just want to be diagnosed. I can tell you, as somebody who's got, you know, neurodivergent children, and also as a late diagnosed ADHD myself, people aren't just going out and waking up one day and deciding that they want to spend, you know, thousands of dollars or wait months and months to go and get a diagnosis of autism or ADHD. In my experience, particularly diagnosing, you know, or as part of a diagnostic team, particularly for late diagnosed people, it often comes on the back of, you know, really significant lifelong challenges or struggles, or feeling like, you know, everyone else in the world seemed to get a manual or a rule book on how to do life, and for some reason I just didn't seem to get it. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to get. And absolutely, I don't know of any telehealth clinics, certainly not ours, that are just saying yes to everybody who comes forward for a diagnosis. There's initial conversations with somebody and initial sort of basic questionnaires just to kind of see whether it may be the right track, or whether in fact maybe it could be something else that requires, you know, going straight to a psychiatrist or a different sort of field, you know, for a different kind of diagnosis. But even if you do go through all of those assessments and checklists and interviews and questionnaires, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get that diagnosis. Mm. And, you know, I think it's really frustrating, because there's, you know, there is a lot of misconceptions, you know, Even this morning, I was reading on a lot of news channels on the back of the Four Corners episode, you know, all these people want an ADHD diagnosis to get on the NDIS. That's ridiculous. ADHD itself isn't on the list for NDIS to give you funding. For most of us, it's actually just so that we can understand how our brain works, why it may be that we've struggled to do certain things or why we're doing a million things at once, and putting some strategies in place for ourselves. For many of us, it's not even about seeking medication. It certainly wasn't for me. I've got absolutely no desire to go on medication. I don't think I need it. I love my brain. I love the way it works. But what it's done for me is it's made me realize what areas of my life that I really struggle in because of my ADHD and what I excel and thrive in, and trying to make sure that I'm building my life that works with my neurodivergent brain, just as every single person should be doing, whether we have a diagnosis or not.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting with Sarah Hayden about getting diagnosed with ADHD in her 40s. If an adult diagnosis of ADHD is something that you have lived, I'd love to hear your story. What's it changed for you? What was that process like for you? One person says, my diagnosis was an incredible new aperture to view my past choices through, and it's really helped me to change my life to better suit my future. This person says, I'm not sure about medication yet. Well, also here with me is Dr. Maddie Derrick, a clinical psychologist who specialises in ADHD and also helped pull together Australia's first ever clinical practice guidelines for assessing and treating ADHD back in 2022. Maddie, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Tegan. Good to be here.
So listening to Sarah's experience of parents seeking out a diagnosis after their child receives one, is that a common story that you hear?
That's very, very common. It was my own experience as well. So I think what seems like an explosion of ADHD diagnoses is actually catch up for the generation of women in particular who are only seeing information about ADHD now that allows them to connect the dots for themselves. And that information coming about through, you know, the process of researching what is going on for their own child and how best to support them.
So one of the big focal points of the Four Corners investigation yesterday was concerns around specialist ADHD clinics, of which you run one. How do you respond to those concerns?
Yeah, it's I suppose that there's two parts. I remember very clearly the decision making back in 2017 about do we call ourselves Hobart ADHD consultants or Hobart psychology? And at that point, because there were so few services, there wasn't a single service in the country that I could find that mentioned ADHD in its title. I thought it was important to really signpost, we're here, this is what we do, because I understood that it was very difficult for people to find ADHD specific support. So I'm not from that side of, you know, a service that is set up to treat a specific condition and whatever is coming along with it, co-occurring, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's been useful in the context of you know, navigating the system for people. I think the telehealth services that have sprung up purely for the purpose of doing a quick assessment, a report back to a GP, usually for co-prescribing by the GP in the person's state. I think there's a mix of people that are doing it really well and as we're seeing the demand and doing their best to meet that demand to be as efficient and therefore affordable as possible while still trying to be effective in what they were doing. But there's certainly a mix of people that you can't justify the costs. And the reports we're hearing back are indicating that they're driven by profit more so than patient outcomes necessarily.
Some stories on the text line that really echo what you're saying there, Maddie. Matt says, my ADHD diagnosis was officially diagnosed in my mid-40s. It took over 2 years and it came after a lot of sessions with my psychologist and GP first to confirm it was not trauma versus ADHD, which was frustrating at the time. It was a relief to finally have those boxes checked, then move on to a psychiatrist for official diagnosis, even though my psychologist had confirmed it was very likely based on his tests. all up would have easily cost $3,000 to get diagnosed. Very frustrating and disappointing that I feel a bit robbed that I had to pay this money. Matt says, what do less fortunate people do? Other end of the spectrum, one says, I received a diagnosis from one of those telehealth clinics, a survey and a 40-minute chat via Zoom, went back to my doctor and reported how bad it was. I do have ADHD, but that initial diagnosis was dodgy. So lots of variation, it sounds like. Maddie, you were involved in pulling together the clinical practice guidelines. What does gold standard care look like?
For assessment specifically?
For the whole process, I think for this initial assessment diagnosis.
Yeah, so clinical interview, where you're actually having a conversation, whether that's in person or via telehealth, that is the bulk of the assessment data you should be getting as a clinician. The questionnaires are there to help get a quick grab of information about a range of things, and particularly from an observer, someone close to the person, your patient or client. But really, it does need to be a clinical interview. The challenges with ADHD assessment are not about detecting whether the symptoms are there enough. It's about detecting the extent of impairment, and it's about trying to sort of reverse engineer the difficulties that someone is experiencing to work out if that is coming back to a cognitive profile that is like ADHD, or whether it's being caused via, the difficulties are caused via stress related to other conditions. So it's quite complex, and the fleshing out of that can't be done in a questionnaire. That's got to be this clinical interview where you're kind of following your nose and asking the right questions as you go, depending on what the person is, how the person is responding.
Have you seen an increase in demand over the past few years?
Enormously. I think it is possibly settling a little bit. I don't know, for our practice, we had a 2-year wait list for assessments for adults up until probably a year ago, and that's come right down now. So I think it is the telehealth providers popping up that have been able to address the needs, but obviously not in a acceptable manner for many.
So you talked about how thorough the assessment has to be, and that really seems to be a theme that comes through. What is the risk of rushing that? What are you potentially getting wrong?
The biggest risk is that you're missing something else that is a better explanation. So the whole point of making a diagnosis is to guide treatment. Based on that diagnosis, you have a starting point to do your treatment planning. So if you're starting with the starting point of ADHD, when the problem is actually anxiety, for example, or PTSD or something else, then you're going to be going down the wrong treatment pathway. And there are some big differences. It's not that you're going down a treatment pathway that is just a waste of time. It might actually be worsening the situation. So, for example, the way we treat anxiety that is within ADHD, that is because of having ADHD, that the treatment for that, it looks very different than if it's anxiety that is coming from an anxiety condition in and of itself.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Dr. Maddie Derrick, a clinical psychologist who specialises in ADHD. Maddie helped develop Australia's national guidelines for assessment and treatment. And you're telling me your stories of what adult diagnosis has looked like for you. Quite a few stories are coming from people who love someone with a diagnosis. One says, as someone who was a support person for someone seeking a later in life diagnosis, please understand that it is such a process. It was a long and arduous journey over 2 years and changed so much for our whole household in a positive way. Thank you for having this conversation. Marie says, my son was diagnosed ADHD, so autism and ADHD, 3 years ago at age 25. He tried the medication but doesn't like it. But the diagnosis explained so much and made me less judgmental about his ability to organise his life. So instead of yelling, I help him with management strategies. Maddie, the data that we saw in Four Corners last night very much focused on prescribing rates. That was how it looked. But what I'm hearing from some of these texts and from Sarah's story is that medication isn't a given as being part of a management strategy.
No, the guideline recommendations based on evidence are that people should be offered medication and should be offered non-pharmacological or psychological intervention. And, you know, the choices that someone makes at that point are up to them, of course, as long as it's based on good information about what those two treatment avenues look like. And they're targeting very different things. Medication is targeting ADHD symptoms and trying to reduce those. Psychological intervention is looking at functioning more broadly, which might involve being finding ways to do things that work better for the person's brain and they'll have more success. But it's also about how we cope, how we respond, advocate for ourselves, etc., when things are too difficult and we're not able to meet the demands.
A text has just come through, Maddie, that I'd love you to speak to. I think it kind of illustrates what you were saying before about the risks of a misdiagnosis. This person says, my partner was diagnosed incorrectly with ADHD by one of the telehealth companies on Four Corners last night. The GP was then managing it. It resulted in psychosis and the destruction of our relationship. Follow-up care has been very poor. The stakes are high, Maddie.
The stakes are high, that is very serious and something that definitely needs to be managed. I do want to point out that the stakes are also high for someone whose ADHD is not identified and not treated, and can be equally as high in terms of cost to life. And the simple fact is, what this data clearly shows us is that there are still more people that are not being diagnosed than there are people potentially that are being diagnosed that shouldn't have. So we've got a much bigger problem with underdiagnosis than overdiagnosis, and the risks that come with underdiagnosis aren't being discussed, but we've got really good data about those risks, and they can be just as severe for individuals.
So in addition to this chat that we're having today and the reporting on Four Corners last night, on Friday, my colleague Beverly Wang talked about neurodivergence in the workplace, and there was a big response to that of people talking about courses to unlock your superpower or understand your brain. And it kind of feels like alongside this increase in awareness of ADHD, which I think a lot of people have found really useful, there's also been people maybe looking cynically, you could be seeing them as looking to cash in on this. How do you suggest people navigate this if they're just looking for information to help themselves?
Look, this is interesting. And I think it's not, you can't make quick judgments about this, I think, and particularly talking to people with lived experience, as you've done, is really important, because people with lived experience might see this quite differently than some other health practitioners do. You certainly, as soon as your algorithms on social media pick up that you've got ADHD or you're interested in it, you certainly start getting targeted with a whole lot of apps and online courses. What I think is that these aren't necessarily all bad, and for people that haven't been able to access good quality care from a health practitioner or allied health professional because it's not affordable or because the people available to them don't have that expertise, I think these are a good next option. Some of these online programs are going to be really, really good and evidence-based. And so we'd be looking for programs that do involve a health practitioner and that they are also in, I would say, have the influence of lived experience. And there are plenty of those. And what I would say for I think there is not enough credit given to the importance of the influence of lived experience, because we don't have a good understanding of what ADHD is. We don't have all the research that we should have. And the lived experience community, what they discuss anecdotally, is really streets ahead of research. And what I notice is a pattern of when major research work comes out talking about strengths of ADHD or all these sort of new areas that are being looked at, all it does is confirm what the lived experience community have already been talking about for the last 5 to 10 years. So there is merit in those programs. They shouldn't be immediately dismissed, but I think looking for a health professional's involvement along with lived experience involvement is key.
Well, Maddie, thank you so much for joining me and Sarah for sharing a story. Dr. Maddie Derrick is a clinical psychologist who specialises in ADHD and helped develop the national guidelines for assessment and treatment. She was also diagnosed with ADHD later in life after going through the process with her children, a familiar story. You also heard from Sarah Hayden, social worker and author of Parenting Different, a guide to supporting neurodivergent children, who got her own ADHD diagnosis at 48. And thank you for your texts as well. One says, I'm 72. I was educated in the 1960s and 70s. By the time I was in my 40s and 50s, I self-diagnosed a learning disorder based on my learning history. When my niece was diagnosed with ADHD, I decided to seek a diagnosis for myself, which I received at the age of 68. My life would have been different if I'd had the support I needed from high school onwards. We'll stick around because coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, this past decade has felt like we are in the thick of history. Pandemics, price shocks, war everywhere. In a way, it feels naive to be optimistic or hopeful about the future, but you're about to hear from someone who thinks you don't need to be ignorant to feel bliss.
Smarten up your afternoons on ABC Radio National, each weekday at 1:30.
On Mondays, it's The Science Show.
Every Tuesday, I ask, what the duck? Science Friction on Wednesdays. On the Mind on Thursdays.
Then on Fridays, What's That Rash?
And Lab Notes.
You bring the lunch.
We bring the science.
We'll bring the science.
1:30 weekdays, right here on ABC Radio National. It's never been easier to be a cynic. You listen to the news and war is everywhere. You drive to work burning through a shockingly expensive tank of fuel and sit down at your desk hoping today is not the day your AI assistant replaces you. And a new poll from the Australian National University think life was better 50 years ago. Objectively, it's kind of bleak out here, but does that mean that optimism is dead? If your answer is yes, there is someone I want you to meet because he's got some views about why hope isn't about ignoring reality and why optimism doesn't have to mean being naive. Because it turns out being cynical doesn't make you smarter and expecting the worst might actually be holding us back. With me is Dr. Tim Sharp, a specialist in positive psychology and founder of the Happiness Institute. Tim, what's bringing you a bit of joy this morning?
Talking to you on the radio.
Perfect answer.
Looking out my window and seeing some beautiful trees and a sunny sky after what was a cloudy morning.
Fair enough. So you literally run an organisation based on happiness. How does that play out for you in your personal life?
That's a good question. Let me divide that into two bits. Firstly, the Happiness Institute, despite its name, which is a little bit misleading, it's not solely about happiness. It's really more about what positive psychologists call thriving and flourishing. Now, that includes positive emotions like happiness and joy and satisfaction, but it's also about meaning and connection and, a deeper sense of life satisfaction rather than just the fleeting feeling good emotions that we sometimes have. So as I said, the Happiness Institute's name is a little bit misleading, but it's a catchy title that people seem to like. In my personal life, to be honest, I've spent most of my life experiencing relatively severe mental ill health. So I experienced depression on and off most of my life. So I guess I teach what I need to learn myself. So I've been practicing this for several decades now, trying to overcome my own negative emotions and try to help other people at the same time.
That's pretty full on, Tim. I don't want you to have to bare your whole soul on the radio if you don't want to. But what sorts of techniques have you found are most effective?
The simple answer is the techniques that have been proven by the science. And that might sound a bit obvious for someone like me to say as an expert and professional and ex-academic in this area. But really, the good news is that positive psychology, and actually before that, clinical psychology has developed for over, 60 or 70 years now, some very, very effective tools and some relatively easy things for people to learn. So starting off back in the, a bit before my time, I suppose, the original behavioral psychology and then particularly the cognitive behavioral techniques, which then emerged into sort of more modern cognitive behavioral and mindfulness-based and ACT-based therapies, have been all and continue to be very, very effective for most people most of the time. There's no miracles, there's no easy, you know, magic wand. But, you know, if most of us sort of work hard at learning these proven techniques and practice them and you know, continue to work on them each and every day, they will help most of us feel better most of the time. And then more recently, well, in the last decade or two, positive psychology has taken that a step further and said, well, it's not just that we can sort of overcome or manage our depression or anxiety or whatever it might be, but we can also do things to boost our happiness, to thrive and flourish more rather than just being okay. So I guess I try to practice what I preach. And in very simple terms, these are things like the practice of gratitude, trying to connect more with loved ones, trying to do what for me is meaningful and purposeful, and that's been helping others.
So talk me through, you sort of mentioned these evidence-based things. I'd love to sort of maybe walk through a practical example of what one of them would look like. Talk to me about gratitude as a practice.
Yeah, well, the simplest version of that that many of your listeners might have heard of is called a gratitude journal, or there's several versions of that, or the three good things exercise. So, it's easy for us, and I'm guilty of this myself, fall into this trap myself, to get bogged down in the negative news cycle, and it's easier than ever now with with social media and algorithms and the way they all work for those catastrophic headlines to overwhelm us and to overwhelm all of what we consume. And I'm not in any way suggesting those things or some of those things aren't real. You know, as you said in the introduction, there are some pretty bad things happening. There are some very stressful things in all of our lives at the moment and have been for several years now. But that doesn't negate the fact that there are also good things happening in the world and good things happening in our world. So what a gratitude practice might look like, it'll vary for different people, but it's about actively searching for the good that's going on. It's about actively savoring what's going right in our lives. It's actively celebrating those people who make our lives feel a bit better and make the world a bit better. And we can do that by writing these, the three good things exercises. What are three good things that have happened today? So at the end of every day or towards the end of every day, if you just do that one simple thing, what are three good things? What are three things that went well today? The research suggests that will help. Now, again, it's not going to make everything magically all the problems magically disappear, but it can help us feel a bit better. And if we feel a bit better, then we're more able to cope and more able to do more good.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Tim Sharp, a specialist in positive psychology, the founder of the Happiness Institute. And he says that being informed doesn't have to be a one-way ticket to being depressed about the world, that we can instill hope and optimism even during times that feel pretty bleak sometimes. I'm asking you if there's hope that's inspired you to act, or what is a source of hope and optimism for you? Katrina says, for me, the wonder of David Attenborough's films and programs is that he always ends on a positive note. So clever, exposing problems but leaving viewers with hope. And Katie says, my 27-year-old son and his partner give me hope. This generation is smart, compassionate, generous, non-judgmental and deeply caring for people and the environment. They are the future. So, Tim, talk to me about how to blend optimism with being informed, that we're not sort of just wandering around naively hoping everything's going to be okay. What does that look like in action?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because optimism and hope, which are slightly different but similar constructs within within psychology, are two of the most important, arguably two of the most important constructs that contribute to not just happiness but well-being more generally, life satisfaction, and even things like longevity. Optimists actually live longer than pessimists. So these are super, super important, but they're also highly misunderstood. And the misunderstanding often lies in the fact that people think optimism is the same as positive thinking or what's sometimes called toxic positivity. And that's actually not helpful. Saying everything's fantastic, everything's all right, when in fact it's not, doesn't help. So what real optimists do and this is a crucial, subtle but crucial difference, is real optimism and hope needs to be grounded in reality. So real optimists don't deny problems. They don't pretend everything's fine when it's not. They face up to the cold, hard realities, but, and this is an important bit, but they do it in a constructive way, or what psychologists sometimes call a solution-focused way. So it's saying, it's not necessarily saying everything's fantastic in the world. It's saying, okay, we do have some problems in the world and in my life, but what can I do about it? And so they focus on, there's another construct, related construct called locus of control. What can I do? What can I influence? And if each of us focus on what we can do, even if that's only a little bit, those little bits add up. You know, I can't change the world necessarily, but I can do a little bit in my part of the world. And if all of us do a little bit in our parts of the world, all those little bits of good add up to a lot of good. So again, the really important bit is being grounded in reality, but then taking a constructive solution-focused approach to that.
It's so interesting you say that. Eve has texted in basically saying the same thing in different words. Eve says, I'm trying to instill in myself more self-agency and self-sufficiency. Mm. It comes back to the Stoic philosophy of what is in my control. Well, Tim, there's this new poll out of the Australian National University that puts some numbers around this general mood. It found most Australians think life was better 50 years ago. Do we know if that's true or not?
We do. It's a tricky one because it's actually far more complex than it might appear. And as wonderful as that research is, breaking it down or sort of presenting it in sort of simplistic headlines can be a little bit misleading. So the simple answer is yes and no. There really is a mix. So you know, over the long term, if we really look, not just 50 years, but 100 years, the reality is for most of us, things are immeasurably better. We tend to be healthier. We tend to live longer, despite what it might feel like at the moment. Most of us are actually wealthier. We have more possessions, et cetera, et cetera. But, and again, this isn't about being unrealistically positive, there is a mix, and there are some very, very real acute strains and some very real, relatively recent stressors. And so things, particularly, I think, the things that are coming out in this and that have come out in other similar surveys are things like housing affordability, cost of living, inequality, wealth inequality, concern about the future, particularly things like the climate. So these things are very real, and they're a very real concern for a lot, particularly for younger people who are, again, being locked out of housing, et cetera, and even the rental market. So again, it's a mix. There are some very real, very serious stressors, but they don't negate necessarily, they shouldn't necessarily negate the longer term gains, which are also quite real.
There's a text here that I want to put to you, Tim. One, this person says, I'm not sure I understand the gratitude thing. I do feel very grateful for a lot of things in my life, but I also feel guilty that I have more than others. How can I reconcile these two feelings?
Well, that's a very profound it's an emotionally intelligent question, I suppose, and something I've struggled with a lot. I mean, I've had a relatively privileged life, especially compared to several billion people in other parts of the world, and even several million people here in Australia. So I'm incredibly grateful for my life as well. But again, I relate to that question. I can also sometimes feel guilty about that. I guess that the response is that those things can be true at the same time. We can, and this is something that I don't think is talked about enough when in psychology and in these discussions, something I try to talk about a lot when in my work, is that we can experience mixed emotions. We can feel joy and sadness at the same time. We can feel gratitude and guilt at the same time. We can feel excitement and anxiety at the same time. Human emotions are very complex. And again, sometimes they're oversimplified for a variety of reasons, and that's not always helpful. So I suppose what I'd say to that person in the first instance is, that's okay. It's okay to have those dual, seemingly contradictory emotions at the same time. But what I'd also say is that for those of us that do feel grateful, for those of us that are privileged in whatever way, I don't just mean financially, I guess what we can look to do is use that for good. So how can this, I guess what I've tried to do in my life, how can I use my position and my privilege and the things in my life that are good to do more good for the world, to help more people? Other people might express that in other ways. But I think there's not necessarily any rational reason to feel guilty because we have a good life.
So if someone's listening to this chat and going, okay, I want to try this out, I want to try optimism, where do you suggest they start?
Another fantastic question. The starting point needs to be with awareness. And that might sound, I hope that doesn't sound too obvious or too glib, but the reality is each and every day, every one of us has literally thousands or tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of thoughts and emotions that just fly in and out of our mind and in and out of our emotional repertoire or whatever. And the reality is that most of us aren't aware of most of them. We don't necessarily know what we're thinking a lot of the time. We operate on automatic pilot. Now, that's not entirely a bad thing. That can be efficient. If we thought about every single thing we had to do, we'd kind of never get out of bed in the morning. We wouldn't be able to do up our shoelaces. So it's kind of okay to sort of operate mindlessly in that sense, but it's not always okay when it comes to some of the more complex or more important aspects of our life. So in answer to the question, the first thing is what we call mindfulness or awareness. And we can start to do that by stopping on a regular basis, several times a day, whenever, as often as you can, and actually just asking ourselves, well, what's going through my mind at the moment? What am I thinking? What am I saying to myself? And so if we can access that, what some people call that inner dialogue or that self-talk, if we can access that, then we can actually start to know what's going on, and then we can actually start to question it and say, well, okay, and I'm kind of oversimplifying this here, but essentially, is this helping me or not? Mm. If it's overly and excessively pessimistic, if I'm just thinking about all the problems and all that's going wrong in my life, that's really not going to be helpful. It's just going to lead to me I'll be more depressed, and then I won't function as well. And if I don't function, then I get more depressed again, and that can then spiral down and down. And so the question then becomes: is if my thoughts aren't helping me, well, are there any other thoughts? Are there any other ways I can think about things that might be more helpful? And again, this is a sort of sounding a bit simplistic, but if we can work through that process and practice it and get better and better at it, and it's a skill like any other skill, the more we practice it, the better you get. Then if we can gradually start to think more helpful thoughts, then we will experience more positive emotions, and then at a very simple level, we will live a better life.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for sharing your insights today. Dr. Tim Sharp is a specialist in positive psychology and the founder of the Happiness Institute. And you've been telling me how you embrace positivity in the light of a world that can feel a little bit bleak sometimes. Martin says, 5 years ago, I regretfully cancelled my long-term subscription to a major international newspaper because on balance, it was just too much bad news. I do watch and listen to news daily, but also subscribe to sources like art and science journals, a good mix of what's going on in the world, what's going wrong in the world, and what's going right. Mary says, maintaining wholesome motivations and aspirations. Maintain your perspective on your small role in the enormity of nature and life. Maintain your good presence in the small sphere of your neighbourhood. Mary says, P.S., negativity is toxic and contagious. Well, I'm still here with you for a bit longer on ABC Radio National. It's Life Matters. And up next, what would change if kids were allowed to wear their sport uniform every day?
They shall grow not old.
Join us to commemorate Anzac Day across the ABC.
Age shall not weary them.
From coverage of the dawn service and march in your capital city, to the services at Gallipoli and Villers-Bretonneux.
At the going down of the sun and in the morning.
Anzac Day 2026.
We will remember them.
On ABC TV, iView and online, on ABC Listen and here on ABC Radio National.
Do you have a go-to outfit for certain parts of your life? There's the old clothes you throw on for the garden, the whites for a game of bowls, the activewear that somehow makes a workout feel more likely before you've even left the house. I think we all do it. We step into a kind of uniform, not just for practicality, but for mindset, because what we wear can nudge us towards action. So when you think about uniforms at school, should we do away with the stiff collars and polished shoes and just let kids wear their sports gear. Because right now, the vast majority of kids aren't moving enough, and something as simple as what they wear can either help or get in the way. And this simple change could have great benefits to your kids' health and well-being. Here with me is Belinda Peden, a senior research assistant in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Newcastle. Belinda, what did your sports uniform look like in high school?
Oh, good morning, Tegan. Thanks so much for having me. My sports uniform actually transitioned in high school. So I started off in the pleated netball skirt, which was not really conducive to moving around. And then thankfully my school brought in a knitted shorts and polo shirt, which I found much more, I could move more freely and I could run around. We could, do gymnastics and all sorts of things, and I didn't feel self-conscious in it.
One of the big activities when I was a kid was doing handstands against the wall, and the netball Yes. skirts did not go well with that.
No, they did not. And in fact, one of the things my colleagues has been told from girls in primary schools in particular is that they don't feel like they can even catch a ball in the playground above their heads because their skirts or their dresses ride up. And so important when we think about kids at all ages in terms of how they want to move and how they're going to be active is what they're actually wearing and how that affects how they move.
Well, I was looking at the data yesterday on the number of kids who meet the recommended physical activity guidelines. The numbers are a little bit hard for me to crunch. You might be able to do a better job. But my understanding was that when it comes to older teens, like 14, 15 and up, like 83% are not meeting physical activity guidelines.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's really concerning. It's an issue globally. In Australia, approximately across all the age groups, it's about 80%, which is a huge proportion of our young people that aren't active. Globally, it's sitting somewhere around 70%. And the impact of that is huge for their health in the short term, but also in the long term.
So what was this particular research that you've done? You weren't looking at activity so much, but you're looking at attitudes towards sports uniforms.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that's come out of some of the work that our group has done is that while teachers, parents in particular, and students themselves are really supportive of being able to wear their sports uniform more often, in fact, they love to wear it every day, the principals are often a little bit less supportive and they've got some concerns around it. And one of the concerns they did express was what the community thinks, the kind of expectations around uniforms that students should be wearing. And so that prompted us to look, what does the public actually think? Has anybody looked into this? And so we're really excited that this is one of the first studies to look at what the public actually thinks in terms of the uniforms our kids are wearing to school.
What did they tell you?
Yeah, interestingly, we were coming from the perspective of, will it make them be more active? And that certainly shone through quite strongly. And it's not just active at school, so definitely more active during lunchtime and recess time, but also travelling to and from school. So if they're in a more comfortable uniform, they're likely to ride their bikes or be more active on the way to school. But what really surprised us was some of the other aspects that came out of it that are probably, I guess, more in a well-being or a equity and inclusive kind of aspect. And so some of them were around engaging more with their learning. Some expressed that their children attend school more often. So the uniform is actually preventing kids from going to school. And then there's the aspects around girls feeling more comfortable when they've got their periods in their sports uniform. And children who are maybe more gender diverse are feeling much more comfortable in a more gender neutral sports uniform.
Is the thing with traditional uniforms that there is sort of a sense that you're preparing them for the workplace, that maybe you might need to wear a tie or trousers or whatever? Is that maybe where this idea of a formal uniform has persisted?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Tegan. So some of the comments that were, we looked at responses from over 2,000 responses and 300 comments, and some were saying, it's really important for children to prepare for the workforce and they need to wear a formal uniform and it's important for discipline. But overwhelmingly, comments were actually refuting this and saying that modern workplaces don't actually require people to wear ties and jackets and they're moving away from that kind of formal structure. And in fact, modern educational and workplaces are actually much more relaxed in terms of what people are required to wear. And so why are our children, I guess, caught in what some described as an antiquated notion of, this traditional formal uniform?
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm with Belinda Peden, who's a senior research assistant in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Newcastle, on research about community attitudes around what uniforms kids should wear to school, whether they should be allowed to wear sports uniforms every day. I'm asking you what you think about this. One text says, my kids both go to public school in Canberra. They have a very relaxed and casual sports-like uniforms. It may be a coincidence, but most students actively travel to school. School is about learning, and being comfortable promotes learning. So Belinda, this is one research paper in a big kind of group of work that your research group has done. Where do you see this going next?
Yeah, firstly, can I just say I feel extreme gratitude to hear what you've just read out in terms of the school in Canberra. That makes me very happy. So in terms of our future work, so I'm just starting my PhD now, and we're looking at, because we know this piece of work isn't easy for all schools. So for some schools, it is a little easier and they're a lot further along the pathway. But we know for some schools, actually changing a policy, putting it into place and dealing with aspects such as, you know, formal occasions where they think that the students need to actually wear a formal uniform, there's challenges there. So we're looking over the next few years to how we can help schools to actually adopt a more flexible approach to their uniforms, and looking at what are the evidence-based strategies that can actually be implemented to help them actually sustain this in the long term. Because ultimately, if our kids are moving more and they're more active and they've got better well-being, then their mental health is better, their physical health is better, and their social health is better. So they're less likely to develop chronic disease, and they're also much more likely to be healthier in the here and now and the future.
It's very much a school-by-school decision, though, isn't it? Are we likely to see broad change?
Yeah, I guess that's the question at the moment. So we've, you know, the school in Canberra that you just mentioned is not on its own. There are other schools in states such as New South Wales and WA that I'm aware of that are doing a similar thing. So it's really, I guess, kind of an aspect that depends on the approaches and the understandings, and I guess the viewpoints of those that are in that policy-making position. And that's what we're really interested in, talking to them and understanding their particular challenges and what might be able to be done to, you know, for some schools it might be every day. For some schools it might actually just be allowing them to wear their uniform, sports uniform, for the full day. Some schools actually still in 2026 require their students to change in and out of their sports uniform for PE lessons. So they're actually predominantly in their formal uniform all the time.
Well, Belinda, thanks so much for joining me this morning. Belinda Peden is a PhD candidate and senior research assistant in the School of Medicine and Public Health at the University of Newcastle. Thank you for telling me about your uniforms too, your sports uniforms in high school. One person says, in Form 1, Year 7 at my high school, the girls spent the first term learning sewing, where we made our sports bloomers and shift, embroidered our names on them, and then we were prepared for PE in term two. It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Thank you so much for your text today. It was really interesting hearing your stories of ADHD diagnosis as an adult. One text says, I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 38. It has been life-changing. I had been thinking about going through the diagnosis for a few years due to the cost and long waiting lists for appointments with reputable psychiatrists, but I decided I did need it. So I went through the process of the questionnaires and interviews. After struggling my entire life and not feeling like people understood why I struggled with basic tasks, it has enabled me to look back with so much compassion for what I went through. Taking medication and specific treatment for it has changed my life. I finally got my driver's license. I've gone back to university and feel so much more in control in a way that I have never felt before. Another person says, thank you for the ADHD conversation. Diagnosed in my 40s, have gained language for my experience, a community of co-work buddies, and a degree of compassion around myself. I'm in a new relationship, which began with my eyes wide open about ADHD, and I feel new levels of safety and acceptance. John says, I was diagnosed severe ADHD at 68, 4 years ago. I've had a lot of grief for past behaviours and failures, but my life and my family's has been changed by very effective medication. One points out, for females, ADHD and perimenopause can be really complex, and I'm finding it hard to get practitioners to help me through this stage when my medications aren't working. We also spoke about hope and optimism today and how to hold on to a positive outlook when the world can feel like a really bleak place. You shared your tips with me. One says, I find peace and positivity by taking care of my health and well-being. Every day is a gift. I go kayaking in areas away from civilization. The experience is holistic and so beneficial. Other activities are walking and jogging. Another says, I'm about to go to a local nursing home to volunteer for my diploma of mental health, and I'm going to ask the residents during craft time what they are grateful for. A lot of them don't feel grateful as they're stuck in a nursing home, but I'm often asking them to tell me something good about being here. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land, but don't worry, I'll be back here again tomorrow. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.